Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby. Joining me is Claire White.
Hello.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. And this is our first episode. Now that we've gone bi-weekly, monthly, what are we doing? We're bi-weekly.
So far, bi-weekly. We'll see how it goes.
We will see how it goes. This episode is on The Expanse.
Woohoo! I love The Expanse.
Yes, yes. If you had downloaded our little reminder that we're going bi-weekly that we released last week, Claire and I mentioned how much we love The Expanse. So what is The Expanse? Well, I'm glad you asked, the hypothetical you. The Expanse is a sci-fi TV show that was released on November of 2015. The show is based on a book series by James S. A. Corey, who I think Claire is going to get into this later, but I think he's actually two people.
Yeah.
Is it split personality, or is he just...
A little bit of everything, Kyle.
I gotcha. The first book in the series was called Leviathan Wakes, and that was published in 2011. The Expanse is set in a not-so-distant future, about 200, 300 years later, where mankind has very painstakingly colonized the solar system. The show concerns, among other things, there's a bunch of themes in this, and there's a lot going on in the show, but one of the big things in it is the political tension between the United Nations of Earth, Mars, which has been colonized for 3 to 4 generations, and the Belt, or people who have carved out a living in the asteroid belt. So those are kind of the three factions, the big factions. And the show's garnered praise for its gritty realism, scientific plausibility, diverse cast, and interesting characters.
It's pretty great.
It's pretty great. I can't sing the praises of the show enough. Claire's going to be talking about the production side and how this book series was turned into a high-budget sci-fi show, which is shocking because the Sci-Fi Network, which is the network it's on, is not notorious with high-budget anything, I feel like.
It's known for Sharknado.
It's known for Sharknado, which is it's low-budget. If you haven't seen it, low-budget.
I'll get to it. Sharknado, the budget, everything.
Sweet. I'm very excited about that. And I'll be talking about the themes of The Expanse and kind of some of the big parts that make this universe what it is, and I can't wait to get to it. So,
Kyle, take it away. I'm really excited.
Yeah, I think I will. So I wanted to do something a little different for my segment. Normally, right now is when one of us would talk about the history or philosophy or maybe the social themes of the subject, but I'm going to take this in a bit more of a science-y direction and literally just talk about the science of The Expanse. The Expanse goes through great pains, at least it seems to me, to really try and do the science right in the show. And it mostly hits the mark.
I know that was really important to the creators. In my research, they talked a lot about when they were developing this show, they really stressed making the science accurate.
Yeah, because it's one thing to have accurate science when you're writing a book series, and it's another to try and like translate that and make it seem plausible and real on screen. And I think they do a really good job with just some simple stuff. Like, I don't think it's, I mean, it probably is really hard, but I don't think it's super hard to make science plausible in science fiction shows and movies.
To make science interesting might be the harder thing.
That's true. So, disclaimer, I am not a scientist, but I am a fan of science, and I do understand the basics of how the solar system of The Expanse functions, because it's how our own solar system functions. Because the biggest thing that The Expanse really nails in the show is gravity and simulated gravity. So let's talk about some realistic gravity.
Kyle is rubbing his hands together like an evil scientist.
So throughout my segment, I am going to compare The Expanse to other science fiction properties. So I just want a little disclaimer here. I don't hate these other properties. Like, I'm going to compare it to Star Wars a couple times. I don't hate Star Wars. But just as, like, where science is done well on screen and where it's not done well. And Star Trek, too, honestly, I compare it to. So in the majority of shows or movies set in space, gravity does not seem like it's a big deal. So, you know, you have in Star Wars, Han Solo and Chewie are running around the Millennium Falcon, no problem. They're not in zero gravity. They seem to have normal Earth-like gravity somehow generated on that ship, though it's never explained. Every ship in Star Wars seems to have solved the gravity problem.
Also, maybe you're going to get to this, but, like, the atmosphere on different planets is never
That's never a problem. Yeah, the gravity of different planets. Every planet must be exactly the same size.
And they get off on that asteroid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just like, nope, it's no problem. But it's the same sort of thing you encounter in any show. And these are all good shows or movies. You know, like I love Star Wars. Star Trek is the same thing. Firefly. Even Battlestar Galactica, which did get some stuff about space, right? And it's never really explained, at least to my knowledge, as to how gravity is supposed to function on these ships.
Right. You don't even think about it.
You don't even think about it. And these ships are set up in like a cruise ship way, where you have like a bunch of horizontal decks, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, especially in Star Trek.
In Star Trek, yeah, and in Star Wars, too, the Star Destroyers and stuff. But the big thing that The Expanse really does like I said before, is gravity and simulated gravity on ships. So how does The Expanse and The Expanse world, how do the ships have this simulated gravity? Because it's not actual gravity. You can't call it gravity. It's simulated gravity.
Why can't you call it gravity?
Because gravity is the force.
Oh, because it's not on a planet.
It's not a mass, a mass pulling something toward it. It's not a gravitational force. It's a simulated force like gravity. So how does The Expanse do this on their ships? They use acceleration. And how can you simulate gravity with acceleration? Well, it's similar to how you feel when you're accelerating in a car or on a roller coaster. You know, you're pushed back into your seat. And that is what how the ships in The Expanse simulate gravity. They're described as looking like skyscrapers with engines on the bottom. So as you accelerate through space, you are being pushed to the floor of your said skyscraper spaceship. The trick is to maintain this, you have to keep accelerating. You can't hit a constant speed and stop and just coast at that speed, otherwise you lose gravity. And if you change direction, your gravity is going to change direction too. And that's a big part of the show. Like, they really stress how much gravity and thrust and force is a factor on these ships. Like, in the very first episode.
In the very first scene.
Very first scene, one of the big, like, it's almost like a set piece. It's just this giant ship turning around. And, like, that may not seem like a lot, but when you're thinking about what that would actually take and what that would actually do to human bodies, like, changing the direction of your thrust and the gravitational force that would put on the human body, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah. Also, you know how you were talking about how it doesn't come up at all in Star Wars or Star Trek or Firefly, so you just don't think about it?
Yeah.
In the same way that it did come up all the time in The Expanse, and they're consistent with it, and because it's part of the world, I barely think about it when I'm watching the show. That's really cool.
That now it's like, that's how they're getting their thrust. It just is. And this is an actual way that NASA is thinking about simulating gravity for longer space missions through acceleration, constant acceleration. Mm-hmm. The hard part is that it has to be constant. Now, what the ships in The Expanse will do is they will accelerate halfway to their destination, and then they'll flip over and deaccelerate for the second half of their journey to the rest to maintain that 1G force. In the way that, like, you know, if you brake in your car, you're going to move forward. So their car, instead of driving forward and braking, they're literally spinning their car in reverse and then slowing down the same rate that they accelerated.
Oh, wow. And is that something that they think could actually happen in space travel?
That is something that you could do in space travel, but it also just maintains the proper math for keeping a gravitational force on the human body, like in space, which is really interesting. So to maintain that 1G force, and 1G is what the Earth's gravity is. That's all our gravitational force we measure and what the amount of gravity that we feel here on the surface of Earth. You need to be constantly accelerating at 9.8 meters per second.
So that would be about
32 feet a second, or 22 miles per hour.
Okay.
So you have to maintain that constant acceleration, and then when the ship flips around to deaccelerate, you're deaccelerating at that same thing, at that same, you know, that same rate, 9.8 meters a second, you're deaccelerating. And that's maintaining 1G of gravity. That's maintaining Earth's gravitational force.
Wow. And so the deacceleration, in a sense, cancels out the acceleration to, like, keep you at like a base.
To keep you at that one, to keep you at that 1G of gravity. Because if you were just constantly accelerating towards, you know, say you're going to Mars, you're constantly accelerating towards Mars. If you got to Mars and just all of a sudden stopped all the acceleration, that's a ton of gravitational force on your body. It's enough to kill you.
So you kind of have to slowly.
Exactly. So you have to deaccelerate at the same rate that you accelerated in.
Okay. I get it.
And one of the things about The Expanse is that they don't, like, you know, tiptoe around gravity. When these ships are going long distances, you know, when they have to like go extra fast to get someplace. In The Expanse, you know, they strap themselves into these seats and they have to take this drug cocktail. It's never actually said what it is, but it's supposed to help your body withstand these massive G-forces for long periods of time. You know, if they have to like change course or if they have to go someplace new or they're trying to like get back from Saturn to Earth quicker.
Super intense.
It's super intense and it's such a small thing, but it's I don't know, I really feel it. And the human body, the record amount of G-forces a human body has ever withstood is 46. And that was for like a split second. But these guys are doing these like accelerations that feel like about 10 to 20 Gs for weeks.
And they mention that this would kill you without that drug cocktail.
Yeah, exactly. It causes your arteries and stuff to start popping, your blood vessels to pop.
Gives me shivers just thinking about it.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I think it's super cool. Now, that is one of the ways that they simulate gravity in The Expanse and that you could theoretically simulate gravity in real life. But there are other ways. One of the more popular ones, at least on screen, is through spin. It's called spin gravity. Or centripetal force is also like what it's known as. So centripetal force is a net force that acts as an object that acts on an object to keep it moving along a circular path. An example of centripetal force is when you have a bucket filled with water and you can swing it around in a circle over your head and the water doesn't fall out.
Right. Okay.
That centripetal force keeps it glued to that bucket. And this is the most common kind of plausible explanation for artificial gravity in TV and movies. You see it in The Martian, if you guys ever saw The Martian. In Interstellar, it's how the Endeavor simulates gravity, the little ship that Matt McConaughey and them are in off exploring. It's in 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, they all,
a few.
They all spin.
Yeah. And it is in The Expanse, but not for spaceships. It's mostly only for space stations. One of the reasons for this is because the smaller the radius of your circle, the faster that circle has to spin to simulate gravity. So it takes a lot of energy to get something spinning really fast to simulate gravity if it's a small radius.
But if it's a space station and it's much bigger.
If it's bigger, it doesn't have to spin as fast. Now, also, when the radius of that circle is smaller, it exaggerates the Coriolis effect. Now, the Coriolis effect gives an apparent force that acts on objects that move relative to a rotating reference frame. And this apparent force acts at right angles to the motion and the rotation axis and tends to curve the motion in the opposite sense to the habitat's spin. So
I was going to say, example, please.
Example. So here's your example. When you're in that rotating space station and you're spinning around, if you move your body either closer to the rotating axis or farther away from the rotating axis, it's going to cause a force to act on the fluids in your body. It's gonna affect your inner ear in this case. And your inner ear is where humans get their balance from, and it also it's what helps us indicate up from down and left from right and keep our balance.
Okay, so it'll mess with kind of your center of gravity.
It messes with your center of gravity and it causes intense nausea. Imagine being like spinning on a Ferris wheel,
God.
Really, really fast to keep your gravity.
I get sick from just swinging.
Yeah.
So
that's why having a larger diameter of that spinning station, it helps to negate and combat that. That little ship in Interstellar that Matt McConaughey's in, that is just like spinning super fast, that would be a vomit box in a lot of ways. It's just going so fast.
But the big space station in The Expanse could, in theory...
In theory, if it's not trying to generate one G of gravity, in Tycho Station, which is the big station you're talking about, I think, in The Expanse, it generates 0.3 Gs, so it's about a third of Earth's gravity. You know, and that is... seems like it could be attainable in the next, you know, couple hundred years, something like that. So to stick on our theme of gravity and how The Expanse does it well, what happens in Star Wars or in Star Trek or Firefly when any of the characters go up to a planet or a moon and they disembark? Why do they feel no change in gravity?
I don't know. It doesn't seem very realistic to me.
It's not. It totally isn't. Because the gravity of a planet is going to depend on its mass. So either in all those things, every planet is the same mass, or they're just not doing it right. And this is a huge part of The Expanse, and it's actually one of the big dividing factors of the three main factions in the show, is that Earth has 1 G of gravity. Mars has about 0.4 Gs of gravity. And the people who live in the belt are operating in about 0.3 or less Gs of gravity. So their bodies develop different. Our bodies are the way they are because they were grown and created in this, you know, under this oppressive gravitational force.
1 G.
1 G, exactly. So a belter, someone who lives in the belt in the expanse, can't physically go to Earth.
Someone who was raised on the belt, yeah. Never was born on the belt.
Yeah, and raised in low gravity, cannot go to Earth. They will die because their bones are too brittle and their physiology is just not made for that. And actually, just a little fun fact, I was looking up, they don't know if it's even possible to get pregnant in space.
Mm.
They don't know if, like, you know, what happens with sperm and eggs, you know, when there's no gravity and maybe they don't have a good sense of where to, you know, which way is up.
They don't know what's up.
They don't know which way is up.
Their ears are messed up.
Exactly. Their inner ears are all out of whack. But I love how that is a big part of this, how gravity is such a force and presence in this show. I think it makes it really realistic. And for even just a semi-science nerd, because I'm not a scientist and I don't know a ton about science, but I do love it. And I can recognize when it's being done well. And there's so much more science I want to talk about, but we should move on to Claire's segment.
Super cool, Kyle. I want to hear about the other science, too.
Well, I'm curious about how this show got kicked off, because it's such a cool show, and I feel like not enough people know about it.
Yeah, well, I'll go into it. So, as you said before, James S.A. Corey is a pseudonym for Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank. I'm going to go into a little bit of their backstory, how they came together, and how they came up with The Expanse. Try to say it like you would.
The Expanse, because it's scary.
It's expansive. In 2001, Frank had a successful career. He had created businesses, managed and taken 2 companies public.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he was doing well, and he'd gotten a severance package from a company, and he was kind of, around 2003, coming up with ideas for this space epic, just floating them around in his head, apparently. He was heavily influenced by Alfred Bester's My Stars, My Destination, which was written in 1956, and it's a novel about a man marooned in space while an interplanetary war between the inner and outer planets is going on.
Sounds familiar? Very familiar to The Expanse.
Yeah. So a friend of his, for whatever reason, had an opportunity to develop a massive multiplayer online game, MMO, for a Chinese internet service company. And basically, it's developing a huge world.
Yeah, a huge world with factions and stuff in it,
right.
You know.
And this friend thought Frank's space story sounded like a really good fit for her game. So to develop this world, he researched the solar system's major bodies, Ceres, Ganymede, the moon, Eros, and he set up political discord guided by a grand terraforming plan. And terraforming, for those who don't know, is where people are altering a planet to make it more like Earth or more inhabitable.
Yeah, to make it livable, give it like an atmosphere.
Yes. And the political balance would drive the game's conflict.
Okay.
So the people they pitched it to, it was like a Chinese company. I didn't find a lot of details on that. Basically didn't realize how much it would cost to make an MMO and dropped it.
Oh, they got cold feet.
Yeah, as soon as it was pitched to them and they saw how much they'd have to pay to make it. Because I think World of Warcraft is really popular at the time and it seemed like a really good idea to jump onto this bus and, oh, wait, this is how much work we have to do and how much money we have to put into it. Oh, never mind. That's fine.
I watched an interview with Ty Frank and he mentions like, yeah, our MMO was going to be even better than World of Warcraft because it didn't have just 2 factions. It was going to have 3
factions. I did hear about that. So later on, Frank didn't quite drop the idea, and he started to run the game as a role-playing game on a post-play forum. So people could just kind of come on and fool around with it if they wanted to. And this heavily influenced the book. And it's where the storyline and characters began to emerge. And the original crew of the Rocinante, which is like the little ship that's kind of the focus of the story, came from. And these crew members were people playing the game in this original online forum. And he actually credits them in the first book. Like a special thanks to these people.
I love that. That this was like, that this book series started out as almost like a D&D game gone off the rails.
And
space
I think
D&D.
One person had to leave early, like he had to drop out of the game, and that character gets a violent death.
Oh, no. I know who it is.
which I love, too.
Yeah.
Abraham, to switch gears to the other
because there's
writer,
two authors, yeah.
The two authors. He loved sci-fi growing up, and he started writing self-described, terrible short stories that he says slowly became less terrible. He studied biology in college, and he worked in tech support for about a decade. He eventually worked with George R. R. Martin on a sci-fi novel, Hunter's Run, and then he made a name for himself as an up-and-coming fantasy writer with the series The Long Price Quartet and the series The Black Sun's Daughter. I hadn't heard of either of them, but apparently in the fantasy world,
yeah.
People have heard of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Frank and his wife eventually moved to New Mexico, where Abraham was, and they joined the local a local sci-fi collective called the New Mexico Critical Mass, which apparently some pretty prolific writers are in, including George R. R. Martin.
Oh, wow.
And through this, he met Martin and actually started working as a personal assistant for him. Frank and Abraham became friends through the collective, and Abraham started playing Frank's RPG.
I just want to make the point out the science joke that is in the New Mexico Critical Mass.
Yeah, yeah.
Because New Mexico is also where they were testing all those nuclear bombs, and that's how you create a nuclear bomb, is by achieving critical mass.
Nerds. So going back to the RPG, Abraham was so impressed by the level of detail in the game because he put in so much research.
Because Frank had put in so much research.
Yeah, because they thought it was going to get picked up into an MMO. And he realized it would make a great novel. Frank didn't really have any ambition for The Expanse. He kind of just wanted to have fun with it. And Abraham says that the ambition for the novel was all his. So Abraham got him to agree to make it a novel, and he wrote the first chapter. Frank didn't like it, and so he rewrote it, and that's kind of how their collaboration started working. One would write the Miller chapters, another would write the Holden chapters. Those are the two main characters in the first book.
Yeah.
And then they would edit each other's chapters. When they showed the story to friends, the friends told them they liked the story, but it wasn't really worth doing. Space opera was a thing of the past, and that they should write fantasy instead.
Really?
Yeah. But they worked on that. This is like 2009, 2010.
Okay.
But they continued to work on the book, and they got it ready to pitch to publishers. And when they pitched it, they actually worked out a roadmap for additional stories to kind of make it more appealing to publishers. And they pitched it as a trilogy. Like, we know where this is going.
Yeah, yeah.
Some publishers passed, but Orbit Books, who had already published some of Abraham's work, really liked it and made them an offer for 3 books, which was way more than they thought they were going to get. And Orbit was about to release The Dragon's Path, which was Abraham's novel. So they marketed it as a 2-for-1 ebook pair. So if you bought one, you got the other. And they kind of targeted fantasy readers, which was really smart because this is a really huge, expansive world that fantasy fans could get into.
Yeah, and the world building, because I guess he'd done a whole video game prior to this, was very sound, and the world felt real and lived in.
Yeah, and I've read the first book, and it is very
well thought out.
The book got a lot of early buzz, started to sell pretty well, and by the end of 2011, the Library Journal had put Leviathan Wakes, which is the first book, on their best science fiction novels of 2011. And in April 2012, it was nominated for a Hugo Award, which we talk about all the time. It's kind of like the Oscars of fantasy and sci-fi. Yeah.
In our Binti episode, we talk about the Hugo drama. And this actually, 2012 was before the big Hugo drama.
Yes,
of
they
the
didn't
sad
have any of that.
And the rabid puppies.
Any of that shame on them.
If you're curious about it, listen to the Binti episode.
Yes. Before the second book came out in 2012, Orbit announced that James S.A. Corey, which is the pseudonym for Frank and Abrams, would write an additional 3 books and 5 novellas. After the second book sold really well, Frank and Abraham, I keep on calling him Abrams, took time to outline the series with 9 books or with 12 books, all ending in the same place, depending on what kind of publishing deal they got. So now I'm going to jump over to TV. In 2012, TV was going through a resurgence or a renaissance, shall we say, with some shows. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're called Game of Thrones, and I believe The Walking Dead is how you say it.
I've never heard of them. It sounds French.
Yeah, I think it is. Maybe it
the Walking
Italian.
Dwa?
Yeah, I don't know. And channels were looking for the next big genre piece. So apparently The Expanse received a lot of offers because it won the Hugo, probably got a lot of press through that. And they rejected a ton. They just didn't think people were serious enough about it.
So the writers, you know, they wanted to make sure that it was done well, I assume, or like done to their vision.
They did. And it doesn't seem like they were hurting for money.
Yeah.
You know, unlike some writers where they're just so happy to get the TV
deal.
Yeah,
to get like that TV option.
Which is no shame in that.
No, definitely not.
But they had already had successful previous careers, seemed to be doing fine. So Ben Cook and Jason Brown had been looking for a sci-fi project to adapt. Ben Cook actually asked to adapt it, got rejected. Then he enlisted Mark Fergus and Hawk Ottsby, who had written scripts for Children of Men and Iron Man.
Children of Men is a phenomenal movie. Like, I love Iron Man, too, but Children of Men is one of the best written movies. Oh,
I need to.
Good.
I know I need to. So all of them approached James S.A. Corey, and apparently they just felt the energy. They were sold right away. They went out for drinks and just talked and talked and talked and talked.
Oh, wow.
So then they started shopping the series around, and they found a ton of interest, but sci-fi wanted it the most. And they outbid all the competitors and ordered 10 seasons with 10 seasons. That would be amazing.
That'd be amazing.
10 episodes without a pilot.
Sci-fi outbid everyone?
Yes.
They're throwing around the Sharknado money,
They
man.
Sure are. Now, listen. So, The Expanse is coming out when sci-fi is releasing a ton of shows about space after years of shows like Sharknado. And as
Sharknado was a movie, actually, Claire.
Okay. Years of those kind of shows. Yeah, but according to I actually don't know.
don't
Thank
even
you for
know.
Correcting me. I just was not interested. They have many Sharknado movies, right?
It was a craze that was sweeping the nation.
Isn't it still sweeping the nation?
It's sort of.
Okay, so according to a Wired article by Russ Martin, sci-fi has been releasing shows full of gimmicks and trend chasing. Now, a lot of hardcore fans were kind of upset about this and thought that sci-fi had turned its back on its roots. The show that kept on coming up was Battlestar Galactica.
That's the only sci-fi show I can think of that I thought was like really, really like smartly done or really good. I can't think of another sci-fi show. Although I never watched Farscape, but that gets a lot of
that gets mentioned too.
A lot of crap.
I haven't seen either of them.
Yeah.
Kind of a shame that I haven't seen Battlestar Galactica because it comes up all the time.
Yeah.
I know I've heard sometimes it's not worth starting because it gets disappointing. Well, that's a whole nother thing.
Yeah.
So, but apparently after Battlestar, this is when USA and TNT were ruling the cable world, and it kind of made sense to double down on like kind of sci-fi theme shows that would pull in a more broad audience.
Yeah, yeah.
But in 2013, Comcast, which is the parent company of sci-fi, hired a new head of original programming, Bill McGoldrick. And he wanted to lure fans back with smart, ambitious shows. Basically what they had been doing with Battlestar Galactica in the first place.
And that was back in the early 2000s, Galactica, right? It was like 2003, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the thing is, sci-fi didn't have the money to make space shows. But because of the success of genre shows, Comcast decided to invest in the channel. And now they have the budgets. You were saying that they...
They used that Sharknado money. They really did.
They really did. Well, no, they used that Comcast money.
Comcast money. That they got because of the Sharknado money.
I think they got it because of Game of Thrones.
Okay.
To compete. So what I was going to say is they now have budgets to compete with anyone else in cable. Not premium cable, so they don't actually have that GOT money, but they can compete with The Walking Dead.
With FX, AMC, that's USA. Okay.
And they're working on all these kind of big sci-fi adaptations, Killjoys and 12 Monkeys, just to name a couple.
Yeah. Childhood End was another one, another big one. That's based on an Arthur C. Clarke book.
Yeah, they're really going hard.
Yeah.
And actually, The Expanse is kind of the flagship of all this new programming.
Oh, wow.
And it's designed to win over Battlestar Galactica fans. Now, the plan for the show was to make a good show.
Which is a departure.
Departure.
No, we can't keep saying that about Simon. That's mean. But no, that's awesome about The Expanse.
Make it available. And then believe that the fan base will come. So last year, it was the highest rated show on sci-fi. They were in the top five in iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play. And season two so far has a critic score of 93 on Rotten Tomatoes out of 100, which is very good,
yeah,
and an audience score of 98, which is exceptional.
Yeah.
They have, for the second season, fairly decent ratings. They're no longer the top show on Sci-Fi, The Magicians.
I think The Magicians is the dumbest.
I haven't seen it, but I'm looking forward to watching it. I've heard I'll like it.
No, but yeah, I don't know. My opinion, The Expanse is 1,000 times better than The Magicians. But.
And it's looking like they're probably going to get picked up for a third season. We're about 7 seasons into the second season when we're recording this.
Seven episodes.
Yeah, season.
Yeah,
what's
the
difference? So it's looking good for season 3. And there's a lot of buzz.
Yeah, yeah. And it is very highly reviewed. I just wish more people watched it. Because in my opinion, I think it's as good as something like Game of Thrones. And I guess we'll branch into opinions now.
Yeah. So you like The Expanse, Kyle?
Yes. Of course. I've said it a bunch of times. It's my favorite show on TV right now. And that includes, you know, like Game of Thrones or Westworld, which I like. I like all those things. I loved Westworld when it came out, but... And I don't want to say that The Expanse is better written than Westworld per se, but it makes me a lot more excited.
Yeah, I don't know what that is, because I feel the same way, where I'm watching it and I'm just so happy to be watching it. And I watch a decent amount of TV, but I don't binge shows.
Yeah.
And sometimes, even with Westworld, until the last few episodes, it kind of feels like a chore to me.
Yeah, it would drag,
kind of
drag
plow
it
through it.
Yeah.
But this show, I wish that there were more episodes. I wish that the first season was longer. And I was bummed when I had to stop binging.
Yeah. I was trying to get my girlfriend into it so that I could rewatch the first season with her.
Is it working?
I'm still trying.
Baby steps.
Baby steps. But what's one thing you love about the show, Claire?
Oh, there's so much, Kyle. So I think my favorite part is the universe, our universe. And I think that's what makes it so cool.
It is literally our solar system.
And I love Star Wars, but it's not a galaxy far, far away. This is a galaxy that I recognize, that I understand. And to see that people are living in the asteroid belt, people are living on the moons of Jupiter.
Yeah.
Like,
and it's hard. It's hard living.
It's
not glamorous.
But it's so cool. The idea, like, there's one shot in the second season where you're on a moon of Jupiter, Ganymede, I think.
Yeah.
And then you see Jupiter on the horizon. It's so
cool.
And it gives me, it makes me tingle. I don't know if that's like, you know, when like you're watching someone who's high up and you get like the fear of heights for them, you start tingling for them.
Yeah.
That's how I feel when they're they're quote unquote filming on this moon and you see Jupiter. You're like, oh no, but that's
Jupiter.
So far away, but it's so cool. What do you like, Kyle? What's your favorite part?
I love the characters in this show. Mm. And obviously the science, because I don't want to geek out over the science and then people be like, well, is the story any good? Because the story and the characters are good.
The science is kind of just like extra, the frosting on the cake.
It's the frosting on the cake, and they don't really address it. They're not spelling out how the science works. Mm-hmm. You're seeing it through the different actions in the movie. Like, they're not saying like, oh, well, this is thrust gravity and we have to maintain an acceleration of 9.8 meters mm-hmm. per second. You just see what's going on, you know? Like, mm-hmm. you see that they're going through these high gravitational forces through acceleration, and the science and the solar system just seems so plausible to me. And it is science fiction still. There are things that they do in that show that are pretty much not possible, probably. Maybe like having kids
maybe
in space
200 years from now.
Maybe 200 years from now, yeah, that's true.
But the kids in space have all kinds of birth defects.
They have all kinds of problems. Well, their bodies were designed to live in space. But just the fact that, like, this solar system seems so close, like, I could see it. And like you said before, you that moment on Ganymede with Jupiter, in the very first episode, you see the ship going past Saturn, and I had the same feeling. I was like, oh, that's really far away.
It's so cool. You mentioned the characters. Is that your favorite part, or?
I know I asked you this question, but it's a hard question to answer because there's so many great parts. I do love these characters, though. I think they're really fleshed out. And a funny thing going from the book to the show does a better job fleshing out the characters quicker.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the books. I think I have, I've read the first two, and I think they get better.
Yeah.
In my one to two, it gets better.
Yeah.
And I've heard the third one, it continues to get better.
Yeah, it continues to get better.
But I thought that the show enhanced the books.
Really?
Like, it added in things, and it fleshed out characters, like you said, that weren't done in the books. And that, I, normally I'm one of those really annoying people who is like, well, in the book, it goes like this.
Yeah.
And I am kind of doing it in the show, but it's not a bad thing. It's like, oh, that's a little bit different, but I totally see why that's different. And it's this, this, and this. And,
And you read the book before you saw the show. See, I did the opposite. I watched the whole first season before I read the first book.
Yeah, yeah. So how was that?
It was good. It was still fun. I mean, the first book, it kind of functions like a mystery novel. So there was some part of the mystery wasn't there for me because I'd seen the first season of the show. But it was still really good, and I love the characters. I love Miller. Thomas Jane plays Miller, who's like the kind of hard-boiled detective stereotype, which I thought I would get tired of. I was like, oh, it's going to be...
boring.
But it was done so well, and I feel like he acted really well.
Yeah, you had to have a good Miller, a good actor from Miller.
And the world of The Expanse, and I remember watching a interview with Frank and Abrahams on this. They didn't want it to be just like white dudes in space. And in the books, everyone's very like mixed race, and there's a lot of different kinds of people in space. And in the show, they cast it well. Like, they casted it like that. They couldn't cast it exactly like it is in the book, because in the book, the people who grow up in the asteroid belt are freakishly tall and like really thin limbed.
Right. They got some.
They got that a little bit.
Didn't they say we got every like skinny, tall person in Vancouver?
Like Toronto or Vancouver.
Oh, yeah, to be an extra. But they couldn't. No, they couldn't do all of that. And that's fair.
Yeah, that's fair. But the casting, like, you know, Alex, who's the pilot of the Rocinante, who's, you know, the kind of part of the crew that you're following through the show and the book, is an East Indian. And in the show, they cast an East Indian guy.
Right. Well, also, because Mars was colonized by Texans and Indians.
And Chinese, yeah.
Private companies.
Yeah, by private companies from China, India, and Texas.
People who look of Indian descent but have a Texan accent.
Have this, like, thick Texas accent, yeah. And he nails it. Cass Anvar is that actor. He's really,
super
really
good.
Yeah.
All the casting is really well done. Also, I didn't get to mention this in my segment, but James S.A. Corey, or Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank, is in the writer's room of the show.
Yeah, like, they're writing.
They
which
are
is unheard
writing.
Of.
It's more heard of now.
Is
actually,
it?
Okay. It's becoming more of a thing. But they're kind of leaping off George R. R. Martin writing an episode each season for Game of Thrones. They're coming into the room and writing every episode with a group of writers.
Yeah.
And apparently, like, they're writing the seventh book right now of The Expanse. So if something comes up that will mess up the world in the seventh book, they can just say, hey, don't do that.
Yeah.
We have plans for that later.
Don't worry about that.
And they were saying that they feel, I mean, obviously they feel this way, but the way to really capture the essence of a work is for the original writers to be there in the room.
Yeah.
And also, it's a big part of the marketing strategy is to actually,
really?
Like, galvanize the fans of the book by having the writers come and promote it. George R. R. Martin does that for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just think if the casting for this sci-fi show can be so good and they can find the right people for all these different like roles of people of color and women, it gives no excuse for any show in the future to be like, oh, well, we just couldn't find someone who was
brown
and good for this role. It's like, come on, man. If Sci-Fi Channel can do this, then FX can do it, or HBO or Showtime or Starz can do
if
it.
If the people who made Sharknado can get it together, then you can get it together.
Exactly.
I was nervous about it when I started watching the show because I'd read the books, and a big part of the books is how diverse this world has become, and that it's no longer racism, it's planetism.
Yeah.
I guess is the right word. Yeah.
Gravityism, almost.
Gravitism.
Down the well. That's the people who grow up down the well, the gravity well.
Yeah. Oh, so good. But I was nervous about how they were going to cast it. Because in the very first episode, James Holden, who is kind of the main character, is dating this girl. And in the books, she's African.
She's Nigerian.
Nigerian. Yeah. And in the TV show, she's a blonde.
She's a blonde woman.
And I got really nervous. But after that, everything else fell into place.
Yeah.
So I'm perfect. Not sure why she was blonde. Maybe they didn't want to scare people off right in the beginning.
I don't know.
I don't know. It was weird.
It was random, but you're right that like the rest of the show, it's like, oh no, we did a good job casting these main characters. Because that character who's dating in the beginning, she's not important, you know.
She doesn't stick around.
You don't see her much longer.
Yeah.
So I watched this panel on YouTube, and it was a panel of people from The Expanse, actors and writers. Ty Frank was there, who's one of the authors. Naren Shankar was there, who's one of the writers for the show.
Yeah, he's the showrunner, I think.
He's the showrunner, and he's a science consultant for it. And I had a bunch of the actors. The guy who plays Amos, Wes Chatham, who's one of my favorites.
He's great.
Was on it. But they were on a panel with actual scientists and physicists from JPL, which if you don't know is a Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and Caltech. So these the people who work with NASA, the people who sent the rover to Mars. And the scientists on this panel from Caltech and JPL, of all the scientists on the panel, there was only one white male. Everyone else was either a woman or of an ethnicity that wasn't European. And that just struck me so hard with this show that, like, the casting is so good and it's so diverse, and that when they open that panel up for questions, a lot of the people who go to Caltech, who work there, who were at this panel just to watch it, came up and said, it feels so good to see someone who looks like me in space.
That is cool.
And these are the actual scientists.
Everyone is in space.
Everyone is in space. And these are the actual scientists who are working on the science that could potentially make something like The Expanse happen one day.
And didn't they also say that there was a part, I'm not going to spoil it, but basically the way that they depicted the gravity was so well done that they actually applauded.
That one of these planetary scientists, this woman, I think she's from New Zealand, her and her husband applauded, yeah.
Yeah, while watching
while
the
watching
show.
While watching the show, they were like, yeah. So I will definitely post that on Facebook. And guys, if you haven't watched The Expanse, the whole first season is on Amazon Prime. If you have Amazon Prime to stream, definitely check it out because it is so freaking cool. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com. We would love it if you would leave us a rate or review on iTunes. Hopefully a good one, but if not, we can take it. We have thick skin. You can find the show on Twitter at DSRA Podcast. I can be found on Twitter at Klex303. That's KLEX303.
I can be found at Along With Claire. That's CLAIRE.
And you can find our producer James at James Fowey Jr. That's James Fowey, FOUHEYJR. You can learn more about The Expanse and science and gravity and the Sci-Fi Channel.
And Sharknado.
And Sharknado and everything that is cool in this world on our Facebook page, where we will be posting some of our show notes, articles, videos that we used while researching this podcast. Our producer, who is a belter in the streets, but an earther in the sheets, it's James Fowey. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, who would not be out of place in a Martian Marine spacesuit, gunning down silly soft earthers and belters alike. And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, who is weirdly an earther on the streets, but a belter in the sheets. Actually, the exact opposite of James Fowey. If you put them in a room together, they explode. It's weird.
I don't even know what that means.
It was a sciencey joke.
Antimatter. Above my head.
Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, the Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and as per our new format, we will see you not next week, but in 2 weeks.